Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navajitamastama Vidvishvavahai Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Okay, we're on Adhikarana 4. Krishna is the ideal saint. So one should approach Sri Krishna through his transparent medium, spiritual master, and thus Sri Krishna will reveal himself. Okay. Then on the next page, lesson 26. One can begin to practice such devotional service. Okay. One can begin to practice such devotional service under a bona fide spiritual master. And by doing so, one can gradually revive his God consciousness, even in this mundane world. Right. So still is the association of devotees, right? So that by that association, then within this world, it can be done. We have to, it's always the point is that it's God's creation. It's his cosmos. So it's not a matter of that you can do something here, you can't do something there. No, it can always be done. But the point is that here naturally it's the place for those who are distracted. So that means there will be distractions. Right? But the point is if one is Krishna conscious, one's not distracted. So it's being a superior level of consciousness that can be practiced even here, right? Like that. So one doesn't have to worry. So that's why it says, even in this mundane world. Otherwise, we would think it's material. And so spiritual, God and spirituality, devotional service is spiritual. So you wouldn't be able to practice that here. No, but it can even be practiced here because it's still God's place. It's just not the best place, you know. We're out in the basement to the garage, right? You know, instead of being up in the living room, right? So, but it's still God's place. Lesson 27. God consciousness, or transcendental loving service of God, is never imposed artificially upon any living being, but is inherent in him. It can be revived only by practice. So, this idea is that, well, this is not natural. We'll go, oh, the Vedic culture is not natural, there's so much restriction, or it doesn't practically apply, or, you know, some will go on and on and on. But that's saying that it's an imposition, that the mundane consciousness is actually the normal consciousness, and spirituality is something artificially applied. But this, the point here is that it's not artificially applied. This is natural to the soul. Being conditioned, that's artificial. Right? So that being artificial, but you know, it's inherent because that's the nature of the soul. You've simply covered, right? We won't say that the living entity that has fallen into a mud puddle, that it would be artificial to have him take a bath and be clean, right? No, being clean is the natural state, right? Being covered with mud, that's something that's been artificially applied. Does that make sense? So, but it says it can be revived only by practice. So engage it from the great devotees, and then only by practice will that come out. It's not that you just hear it and then it's done, you know, but it has to be applied. Lesson 28. The general process is to approach first to the bona fide spiritual master. We want to get to Krishna. We know Krishna through the spiritual master, right? 29. Next stage is to worship Krishna by all means. Then according to the direction of the spiritual master, we apply that in serving Krishna. 30. Next stage is to regulate habits, diet, practice, fasting on special days, such as Ekadasi, etc. Right? So we've approached the spiritual master, we've heard what's the position, we take up the worship by Krishna by whatever we can. Then we start to regulate all the habits, the diet and special fastings. All these different things are slowly, slowly all added in. Right? Lesson 31. One should practice equilibrium of mind so that one may not be disturbed by worldly gain or loss. Right? Because gain and loss is always there. That's because we're talking about temporary. That means temporary means it has to be created, it has to be destroyed. Does that make sense? So gain and loss are just the way the material world is. So if we're going to come to the spiritual platform, which is eternal, we have to not be disturbed by the temporariness of the material world. Does that make sense?
Right. And how practically it can be applied? Like it should be not to be disturbed?
How it means...
not to respond to the impulses?
No, it's not a matter of not responding. It's a matter of understanding. Because the thing is here, it's not that spiritual means, you know, we're like this very pleasantly peaceful zombie. You know, like that. You know, we're not talking about the zombies in the movies, right? Those are bad zombies. You know, we're talking here about good zombies, you know, like that. No, the idea is that one understands the position, but through knowledge, then one is not disturbed, right? Or one is so absorbed in Krishna, one doesn't notice. Does that make sense? Because that's also, you know, so either of those are practical, right? You're so absorbed in something, so you don't notice something else. You know, you happen to be hungry, and then something came up, so you get so absorbed in that, you forget you're hungry. So that's the best, because we're so absorbed in Krishna. But the other is that you don't get distracted by it because of knowledge. You're able to establish what's the position of you, the nature of things, and so that's just the way it goes. Does that make sense? It's not that one doesn't notice it, but it's that one is not affected, may not be disturbed. So it's disturbed meaning one can't perform one's service. Does that make sense? 32. One should practice concentrating one's mind only on Sri Krishna, the Absolute Personality of Godhead, but not to disregard other empowered living beings known as gods. Right? You concentrate your mind on Krishna, but don't disrespect the others. Right? So if we're not disrespecting the demigods, that means we're not disrespecting the devotees. Right? Does that make sense? Right? So, in other words, there's God and all the living entities. They're all parts and parcels of the Lord. So nobody's disregarded. But the focus and worship is just on Krishna. Does that make sense? It's not that to not worship demigods we have to think badly about them. Just we're not interested in worshiping. That's all. Lesson 33. Of all such devotional practices, the most important is the association of saintly devotees, chanting the holy name of Krishna, to live in a sacred place, and to worship the Archamurti of Sri Krishna. So these five principles of devotional service, these are the most important of all the activities to be performed. Because if those are solid, then everything else will come. The regulation will come. The not being disturbed by worldly gain and loss will be able to worship Krishna by all means, right? Does that make sense? We'll properly deal with the spiritual master. All this. Lesson 34. Yes.
Among these five, which one is the most important?
Association of devotees. That's why it's put first. Yeah. You might say it's like that. But traditionally, I think it's put in this order anyway. Because in the association of devotees, then that's when you hear about chanting or the sacred place has some meaning, worship of the deity has meaning. So it all begins with the association with the spiritual master and the devotees. That's why it says the general process is first to approach the bona fide spiritual master. Right? You know, cause, so you're starting with devotees, because it's from devotees that one gets faith, and then from that faith one can practice. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yeah.
Living in a holy place here, some devotees may not associate so much, but they, on the internet they're very active. Is that still called association?
I'm not quite sure.
Well, there's forums, there's, you know, you can get classes, you can see the whole temple program on the internet.
Okay. You can... You know who lives in Mayapur and check out their Facebook pages. No, I didn't. Okay. Yes, means that's association. That's association. The point is that's why they uses the word up here, by all means, right? You know, somehow or another, you involve yourself. If you can't do, then, you know, if there's no temple in your place, then, you know, you're on wine watching Mangal Arati somewhere, right?
And even if there is a temple here, it's still okay?
To go to the temple? I mean, to stay at home and watch on the internet? I know it was very popular. I mean, just as a side point, very popular in Los Angeles back in the 70s. They had put in a thing where you could see, maybe even it was early 80s, they put in something where they had, you know, a video of the Mangal Arati and all that, and they had a channel, I think. And so then some devotees would just, you know, wake up in the morning, turn on the television, while laying in bed, then, you know, take part in the Mangal Arati like that, and afterwards turn it off, go back to sleep. You know? I'm not talking, I don't know if you're talking about that level of, you know, how you say. Yes, or if you're... And the normal thing is, if it's possible, you attend physically, and if not, then you know. The point is, what is not possible, then you take advantage of what are the alternatives. Not that when something's possible, you take advantage of the alternative. You know what I'm saying? That would be the...
I can only count four here.
You can only count four.
Association of devotees, chanting the holy name, sacred place, and worship the Archimurti.
And what will you do in the association of devotees?
Yeah.
No, but what will you do in the association of devotees?
I will
play Monopoly.
No. I'm not very good at that.
Bowling pool. What would you do?
Talk about Krishna.
Talk about Krishna. Yeah. So talking about Krishna is?
It's Krishna Katha.
Yeah, but I mean in relation to the five?
The remembering? Or what?
Hearing Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah, okay.
Right? In other words, in the association of saintly devotees, you're going to hear Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But there is also the element of, besides hearing from them, is also that association with them. You know, that dadati prati grinati guhya. But when you say association of saintly devotees, that means both. So if you give both, it's there. Just like when we say worship the Archimurti, it includes worship of Tulsi. Because some lists it is important to, you know, how you say, hear Srimad Bhagavatam in the association of devotees, chant the holy name of the Lord, live in a sacred place, worship Tulsi, and worship the deity. So it'll mix them there. You know what I'm saying? So whichever way it's done, they're all included.
Yeah.
Like that. Then 34. In the course of practicing such spiritual training, if a devotee commits any mistake, Sri Krishna saves him from falling down. Right? So here, falling down means giving up the devotional process, right? Or falling into, you know, out of a situation to be in contact with devotional service. Does that make sense? So it says it commits any mistake, he saves him. Right? And so then someone may be doing so, it's not quite right. He's not chanting properly, he's not dealing with devotees properly. But if he's sincerely committed to the process and understands it, though he's not necessarily able to always follow it, right? Then Krishna saves him, you know, from being distracted. You know, I mean, distracted meaning giving up the process. Otherwise, if it was up to us, we probably wouldn't be doing so good, right? Lesson 35. Salvation, knowledge, renunciation. All such attempts are mundane rather than spiritual. For one who practices pure devotional activity, all other qualities are automatically achieved. Right? So here, salvation, knowledge, renunciation. You don't have to endeavor it separately for them. Salvation comes with devotional service. Right? Knowledge comes with devotional service. Renunciation comes with devotional service. No, we say, no, but you have to practice it. No, you only have to practice it in devotional service. Right? In other words, you get up in the morning and you're thinking about, yeah, you know, wow, it's, you know, it's cold and hungry, I'm going to eat this and that. You look at the calendar and today's Ekadasi and okay. So now you practice what? Renunciation. Right? You understand? You don't have to separately deal with it. The Mayavadis, they have to separately be renounced. You know what I'm saying? But the devotees don't. Right? There's plenty of Ekadasis, there's plenty of fast days. You know? So, yes.
Sorry. But you said that our process and the Mayavadis process after salvation is the same.
It's the same. But their process is already included in ours. But they have to deal with it separately.
Wouldn't they be also doing like us?
They may, but they just see it as it's being renounced on Ekadasi rather than the devotional element of pleasing the Lord. Does that make sense? So for them, the focus is on renunciation. For us, it's focusing on Krishna consciousness. Then, you know, knowledge also. We hear Srimad Bhagavatam, that's knowledge. We discuss with devotees, we're going to hear knowledge. Like that. We've been, you know, asked to study the books. Prabhupada's asked that. So it's part of the process. Right? So it's not, all these things are included in the process. But they'll study knowledge to become liberated, be renounced, to get liberated, all these different things. So it'll be a great problem because it's not connected with anything. But if you're fasting because it's Janmashtami and you want to please Krishna, that's easy. But you're fasting just because by fasting then you'll get liberated. That's more difficult. You know, because you generally think, oh, I'll get liberated tomorrow. I'll eat today. Yeah, like that.
Yeah. Maharaj, what about if you start to get used to like not eating grains on Ekadasi? Like,
you get used to not eating grains on Ekadasi, so that's a bad thing.
No, I mean, that's like...
Rather than just sitting there... You know, like that. But you have to strap yourself into the chair. is that what you mean?
So it
doesn't have the same, you know, feeling of accomplishment, you know. And then when you fall over in the chair and bang your head, you know, then you have a, you know, some kind of memento to remember for a few days of how austere you were on the cottage.
Yeah, that was a real cottage.
Yeah, that was.
So, yeah, so it doesn't have to be, like, agonizing?
No, the whole point is that devotional service means it's not agonizing. That was the point with Mataji's question the other day, is her, if you're supposed to be detached and only do things for Krishna, then you should choose a service that you absolutely hate.
Yeah.
So that would then be, you know, proper, you know, detachment, because otherwise you like the service. And no, but it said, Prabhupada said in the beginning, one performs the service because he likes the service. Right? But after a while, you start to notice the reason you like the service is because Krishna is pleased. So then Krishna becomes the focal point. Right? So all these different things that are given there, it's like we were saying there, fasting on a special day, equilibrium of mind, is that if you're, let us say, you're doing something for someone, you don't have to regulate your diet or practice fasting or that. You just automatically are involved in taking care of it. Why? Because of the attachment to the person, the affection for the person. So devotional service, that will come automatically. So since that affection's not there, you practice the activities through which that affection is expressed. Does that make sense? You know? So the idea is then by that association, then you're always thinking of that is for Krishna. But you can relate to the activity. The activity has to be done. The body, the mind, the word are going to do that. You know? But then slowly, slowly the consciousness follows that. Right? So that's why the importance of the association of devotees. Because they're always creating the situations in which it's to be followed. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yes.
Maharaj, with the practice of equilibrium of the mind, I wanted to ask you about like a detail of preparation for our sadhana. In one of your lectures, you mentioned about like the art of taking cold bath. In regards to our application with that, if one is getting the symptoms of like a cold, what are we missing?
Hot water? No, the point is that if you're taking care of yourself throughout the day, because generally it's not that you're warm all day and when you take a cold shower, that's when you get sick. You know what I'm saying? It's that you're not taking care all day, so this adds on top of that. You know what I'm saying? So you just have to see that you're careful about, you know, in other words, don't be just concerned about the cold when it comes to time for a shower. You know, it's all through the day. Are you making sure that you're properly warm? Because that, you know, that 30 seconds where, you know, you're in between something and you're a little cold, but you could handle it. But the point is that just all that just adds up. You know what I'm saying? But if you're sick, then one doesn't do that. The point is you get more benefit from the cold bath than a hot bath, right? As far as just the general health goes, right? Warm bath is generally connected with, you know, how you say, you know, scrubbing and cleansing, you know, washing the hair, scrubbing and doing all those things. Then because you're going to be involved in it longer, the warm water is important, right? But generally once all that's clean, then the last final rinse is cold, right? You know, and cold means it's not, cold means it's not warm, right? That doesn't mean it has to be freezing. Huh?
Cool.
Cool, yeah, cool, but means it's not warm.
Room temperature.
Huh?
Room temperature.
Well, it depends on what's the temperature of your room. You know, but basically like that, you know, it means you're, huh?
I was just going to say, I think that Shri Bhavan is coming directly from the Ganga. It is.
Well, then that's not so bad. The water in Gdańsk, in North Poland, that I think there's a block of ice there that there's some little gnomes are sitting there with matches or candles kind of like slightly melting it before it comes through the tap. Yeah. I'm not sure how they do it, but...
If you put water under pressure, you can have it liquid under 0 degrees.
Oh, really? So yes, so they must have perfected that, like that, you know. The point is that it's, yeah, you know what I'm saying? So it doesn't have to be harsh, but it, you know, it's like that. In the summertime, you don't seem to mind that, you know, so it's like that. But the point is it's there, but if one's sick, then one would use warm water. The idea is, you know, also the point is you, if you take a very hot shower, and then when you stop with that, then the air is colder than that. So you want to also find a balance that it's not too hot, that it's you're going to feel cold after the shower. It means that you're worried about feeling cold during the shower, but if you take a cold shower, you don't feel cold after the shower. You know what I'm saying? Like that. For like for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you don't feel cold. So then you can put on your tilak, do everything, and you don't feel it. Well, if you take a hot shower, you don't get that benefit. You'll feel the air will be cold. So you have to find a balance. But if you're sick, then you, how you say? Yeah. Then you just take a warm bath. Or if you're really sick, then you can even take a half bath, or you know, how you say, at least in other in America they call it the French bath. I'm not sure what that means. No, but they don't use that term in France. that's a faux pas, right? Okay. Yes. Okay. Someone else has something. Yes.
Actually, speaking of that, a devotee did once tell me that, like, she was, like, busy with deity worship and all, and, like, in the middle of things, like, her body wanted to do its nature's call. So she said that doing washing from the bottom down is actually okay. Did you ever hear that?
You can do that, but the point is that the clothes that you're going to wear in the deity worship shouldn't be worn in the toilet. Yeah. So the point is, if that's done, and especially if what you're wearing in the toilet is wool, then it doesn't become contaminated. So then things like that work. No, silk's contaminated by air. Silk gets contaminated. Silk doesn't get contaminated by wearing it.
So,
you understand? Yeah. So in other words, silk, if you eat in it, sleep in it, go to the toilet, it becomes contaminated. Only wool doesn't. Yeah, yeah. Silk, the advantage of that is, let's say you have some silk clothes that you use for puja. You can put them on, do the puja, take them off, fold them up, use them the next day. You can do that for 10 days, like that, and then have them washed. But you're only using them during the puja. But if you eat in them or sleep in them or that, then they're not. Then they have to be purified before the puja, right? But silk can be purified like wool by sun, moon, or wind, like that. You know what I'm saying? You know, yeah. Well, that's it's all in the deity worship book. That's one of those books that all temples have, but no one ever reads.
I got up to that level, and then I went back down.
Oh, okay.
My real propensity.
Yeah.
And somebody stole my Arjuna Padati.
Oh, okay.
Living in a temple and
yeah. Yeah, but they're probably not reading it either. you can be satisfied knowing that they're, even though they stole it, they're still getting no benefit. And you don't have to feel so bad. Yes.
Like some devotees follow practice like chaturmasya, staying from
means the chaturmasya, that is just so that it means what it means in chaturmasya, what's the most important rules?
Stay
in one place and no, but what are the specific chaturmasya rules? These are you know, major rules, but not the primary rules. The primary rules is that you increase hearing and chanting. That's the main thing, right? And then to do that, if you only eat once a day, how much time do you save? You understand? That's the point. And that during that time, because generally the weather is such that zodiac, depends on where you are, but by the zodiac signs, they're not that great for the stomach and things like that. You have to be very careful. So then one is taking lighter food and things and being very careful of those things that have nutritionally very powerful, because then it'll create more lust, or it can create sickness like that. So that's why the spinach and the erdal are missed. And, you know, because it's just what is missed out are things that can are very good for the health, but if you're not careful, then they can also create trouble. Right? So those kind of things, and you're careful about that. Then you aren't luxurious in your lifestyle, so you pick something that's less than that. You know what I'm saying? So therefore the grass is always on a nice comfortable bed. You know, bed means those things with the feet and all that kind of stuff. So then they'll sleep on the floor. That means, you know, they'll put their bedding on the floor instead of on the bed. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Because that's... So these kind of things, they restrict that. And it just makes it more simple and everything. But one has to note that it also, there's a rule is one should not be engaged, or like, you know, especially in eating or these kind of things, that there's an over-endeavor for it. You have to endeavor more for it. So let us say like this. The brahmachari every day comes in with no previous arrangement, sits down, eats, you know, and walks away, right? So his time investment is 15 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 in eating, right? And then he goes away. Now, that same brahmachari, when he does chaturmas, because he can't eat what they're cooking for the other devotees, will spend 2 hours arranging his special khichdi with no salt or anything in it. Now, you tell me which of the two is better for chaturmas, according to the chaturmas rules. You understand? So in other words, what comes easily? You have facility, the grass that has facility, you can cook whatever he likes. So he can arrange like that. You know, he's going to put all these different things to make it nice. Right? But in the temple, you just eat what you get. So therefore, you eat, but you eat once a day. When prasad happens, like that.
Because I read somewhere it's like after sunset.
You have 3 points. It's after the noon, after 3/4 of the day, or after sunset. In other words, fasting until noon, that's standard. But whether you eat at noon, that's you once a day, eat at 3/4 of the day, or eat at sunset. That's up to you. I would say it's up to the weather, up to your health, up to, you know, how things work, what will work best for you. You know, like that.
What's the meaning of not shaving?
Meaning of not shaving means you don't spend any time shaving. You get that. So all these things are to get, you know what I'm saying? It's not to, you know, cut a profile. Right? You got the beard. Tough. Like that. No, it's not for that. Yes.
Actually, I mean, being an ISKCON devotee, I never heard about all this. I never heard about fasting till noon. I only heard, you know, no spinach. You know, I was in New Vrindavan, we just threw a little farina into the milk. That's how we got around that one.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get around the yogurt? An Erdal? No one eats it anyway. Yeah, it means if you're South Indian, it is a major problem. For South, it's probably the toughest on South Indians, chaturmas, because they can't eat without yogurt, and everything they eat is made with Erdal.
Yogurt seemed to me the most easy because it came right when the weather was changing anyway.
Yeah. It doesn't really turn into yogurt at that time. Also, if you're making yogurt, you'll suddenly find it didn't turn. It comes out weird, like clabbered milk or something. And then if you check, oh, chaturmas started. But it works like that.
Yeah, that's all I ever heard about.
Well, there's only those four. Those are the main.
And spinach, I mean, spinach, you know, then there's like different interpretations, but it's no problem doing spinach. But we still had salad. We still had collard greens.
Yeah, but the thing is that the green leafy vegetables, that's the generally translation of spinach. And so they're very hard to digest during that time.
The salad is different?
No, it's still hard to digest.
Oh, okay.
Excuse any offenses here. Salad, you never digest. Salad, its only benefit is roughage. That's the only benefit you get. It has all those fabulous vitamins and minerals, but we can't digest cellulose. So we can't get at it. A cow, yes. You know, but we actually don't get at it. So the actual only benefit you get is roughage. You know? Which for most, you know, tropical diets isn't a problem because they eat lots of vegetables and this and that. But in your European diet, then between their meat and bread there is no real roughage. So without salad, basically, you know, if you eat that diet, you'll kill yourself. So the salad is a godsend for them because it creates the roughage. So when you bite, if you happen to, you know, whatever you happen, how much you chew, that you happen to get some of the juice released from those leafy vegetables and all that, you'll get benefit from that as far as the vitamins and minerals. Otherwise, the rest of it won't, because everyone eats salad because it's full of salt, but you can't get it. But if you put it into a blender and juiced it, that, then you get some benefit from it. As
like
far as...
When I would make salad, I mean, one day a week we had salad, but we'd have sprouts and cottage cheese in there and carrots in there and...
Well, the cottage cheese isn't exactly a green leafy vegetable.
Okay.
You know, either it's olive oil and olives and, you know, small cubes of, you know, cheese and, you know, all these things. So the point is that the leafy vegetables, they're hard to digest at that time, so they're just avoided. See, we're always looking for a loophole, but the point is the loophole for Krishna or is the loophole for us? Yeah, that's the point. Because Lord Chaitanya, then, for his mother to follow, so these simple rules, these were given for his mother. That in the codicil, it means no grains and beans. That's it. That's the bottom line. And for Chaturmas, it's these four are avoided. That's the bottom line. Like that. So then when we try to take, oh, that's so fanatic. No, that's four rules out of 44. So we've dropped 40 rules. Right? Yeah, so there's 44 rules. We've dropped 40 of them. Right? And then all the side things we're not worrying about, like eggplant and corn. And beetroots and carrots and all these different kinds of things that are also generally those who are very strict about it, they avoid. So many things that would be traditionally avoided already aren't worried about. So just this last one is there, and even then we'll try to...
And I was taught the loophole of just throwing a little...
That works because you chemically change it. But it means it actually has to cook. It's not that you just kind of like drop it in and that's
no,
it.
Yeah.
It has to cook. It chemically changes it. But what you have to be able to still understand you're going to deal with is the heating effect is still there. So it's create heat in the body. It still will do that. So you're trying to avoid that. You're trying to avoid the heat that will be created by the milk. Just like the particular heat and that will be created by the sourness of the yogurt. You know, that kind of thing. So you have to see it. So you don't have any problem, you don't end up with boils, you know, you don't end up, you know, climbing the walls, then no problem.
So is there any point, and if it's to do with the climate and the season, is there any point in following it if you're in a different hemisphere?
Does the same sun and planets and zodiac signs have effect on other parts of the planet or only here?
Okay.
Okay. Like this. Like this. In the tropical areas, they're using chili in their cooking, right? And so, generally, they don't have a problem with digesting fatty foods. Therefore, they cook with fatty foods since fatty foods are actually the mother goodness. Having a food that has no fat in it is actually the mode of ignorance, according to Gita. So, but the Europeans, they eat all their fat without chili. Okay? Which devotees in the world are always complaining the Indian food's too rich and you can't digest it and this and that? Western devotees who never eat chili. So that's the point. They like the richness when they're young, but they don't put the chili, which Prabhupada showed. And then they'll blame it on Indian cooking. No, it's on their lack of knowledge of nutrition and how to cook. So, it applies anywhere. Because if that's the case, then we should definitely not see any pants in India by any devotees, because this is the wrong hemisphere. This is the place of dhotis. Pants are for the West, where it's, you know, below zero and everything, and you don't wear your pants and boots and that. Your legs will freeze off, right? And though you can, because of the snow, you could get a little toboggan to sit on and push yourself around with your hands because you don't have any legs. But, you know, that's okay if you stay in your place. Does that make sense? So that's the point, is somehow or another it's only the Indian stuff can't be exported, but everything else from the rest of the world can be imported. You know what I'm saying? It's a one-way valve. Like that, very strictly maintained.
Does it make a difference when the salad is cooked for the digestion?
But then it's still a green leafy vegetable.
I don't mean just on chaturmasya, but generally.
Yeah, means slightly. Means the point is cellulose we don't digest. So how much is there? So that's what he's saying. It's valuable as roughage. But to think you're getting all those vitamins and minerals from it, you're not. The cow is. The horse is. Right? The goat is. But we're not. You know what I'm saying? It means this rock has so many minerals in it. You know, I'm sure that it's easily, you know, many times the minimum daily requirement. You know what I'm saying? You know, so therefore, you know, if you ate this rock, you know, you would get so much from it, right? According to the theory. But can you digest the rock? No. But there are bugs that eat rocks. That's their food. Like when they go to carve deities, they go to the mountain where that rock is and they look for where the bugs have been eating the rock. And then they cut from there for making the deity. Right? Because they don't eat dead rock. They eat living rock. You know what I'm saying? You understand the principle?
Yeah, but just trying to figure out the difference between cooked and not cooked.
Means cooked means you're going to break down the cellulose so you can get at it. What I'm saying as far as chaturmas goes, whether it's cooked or not cooked, it's still shock.
I understand.
Like that. That's what we're saying. But as far as nutrition goes, it's better. But at the same time, it's roughage is necessary. So if your diet is such as lots of vegetables, you don't need to eat raw salad. But if it's not, then salad works. You know what I'm saying?
Because in the West they eat raw salad.
Yeah, they eat raw salad. But in the West, traditionally, where do they eat the raw salad?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. No, that's not traditional. That's now. That's modern man. Traditionally, where is it? If you had a formal dinner, where is the salad?
At the end.
Some will be at the end or in the beginning. It's never mixed in between because raw food and cooked food don't mix properly. You can't digest it. You know what I'm saying? So modern man, in the name of nutrition, eats a salad throughout the meal. He'll have problems. Yeah. Like that. But if you eat it at the beginning or at the end, then it'll work better because then you have the uncooked and the cooked and then like that. You understand? So that's why even if you follow the tradition of diet of a local area, that'll work. But they're not following that. You know what I'm saying? They'll say, oh, we're Western. It's Americans. What's Western about them? You know what I'm saying? What is this Western? What tradition do they follow? Or what do you have to do like? What do you mean you have to do like that? The place has been there 200 years. You know what I'm saying? And before that, they were all British. So now they're going to follow all the British diets and everything like that? No. So what does this mean? You can't do it. Yeah. I mean, Indians were living there way before the Europeans came, and quite comfortably. You know, a different lifestyle. Their lifestyle is closer to the concepts of what we deal with. But then they come along and live in the same place. You know, so it's all just, it's just attachment that we say these things. Oh, that diet fits here. Yeah, what is the diet of the North European? It's called, you go out yourself, you know, 20 of you go, attack a bear, kill it, you know, take it home, you know, and roast it on the spit. That's called North European cuisine. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point. You know what I'm saying? We're not talking here Romans and Greeks who had a little bit more sophistication. We're talking Germanic tribes, which means basically speaking all of Europe. So if you're not Greek, right, you're not Roman, you're not Welsh, Scottish, or Irish, then you're Germanic, and that's your diet.
And you finish with coleslaw.
Huh?
Finish with coleslaw.
Coleslaw probably came later because then you have to sit down and actually grow something. You know what I'm saying? So once it got settled, then they started growing cabbages. Then you have coleslaw.
And then also on the Europeans.
The Indo-Europeans, if you go into Central Asia, then that's a different thing.
So in Europe.
But all the Indo-Europeans, those are all the Germanic tribes.
No, they came from India.
Everybody came from India. Oh, you mean the gypsies?
Yeah.
That's another thing. They even speak the language. But that's a different thing. So if you want to go gypsy on us here, that's okay. Just be careful in Bulgaria. You know, you might come at you with a large stick or something. but that's a different thing. But that they generally Europeans don't count them as Europeans. You know what I'm saying? At least the other Germanic tribes didn't. You know, like that. Does that make sense? Like that. They also featured very well in the, the resort facilities in Poland last century. You know what I'm saying? So my point is all this concept of, no, we're from this place, we have our thing, and this is our lifestyle, that's all nonsense. That's just what is developed. You know what I'm saying? So you read about something, you know, if we started a whole thing about rocks and how much you get out of it and all that, guaranteed, in a very short time, you'd have companies making very super fine rock powder that, you know, then you can mix in with the different things. You know, some would even, you know, color it or flavor it or, you know, it would start happening. But that doesn't mean it's our food. You know what I'm saying? That's the whole point.
Another substitute used for the chili to richness?
It's called black pepper.
Black pepper. So those who don't like chili, they can use black pepper? Or is it dependent?
If they know how to use it, yeah. It means people don't like chili because they don't know how to use it.
Master,
Kasundi is also like chili? Do you all into this? No, that's
like an achar. It's like an achar. There is also sub-ghee.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that you don't put chili for the ghee.
Oh, okay.
Right, because you get all the different tastes and all these things like that. But it is pungent, but it's a different part. But it does help. So on your cheese sandwiches, put mustard.
And potato chips.
Can, but you have to have enough mustard and pepper, otherwise then it won't all work.
When I was growing up, I would go to the pool and, like, they would put mustard on the potato chips, and, like, it just grossed me out, but then... A few years ago, I tried it and it was good.
Yeah. But don't believe them about the Limburger cheese, though. Okay, then read it again. Okay, so. Had enough digression for today, is it? Yes.
Just a short note about this Fortalicano. These lessons from 20 till 26, if you look at them, you could actually take them in a different way. You could look at them as a description of the qualification of the spiritual master. For example, if you read 21, the last part of Sri Krishna is acceptable only to those who have undergone transcendental training. Could be taken as the spiritual master. He has taken on this training. And therefore, he's qualified to teach. And then, 23, such a pure in heart devotee is not only rare, but is very much dear to the heart of Sri Krishna also. Can be taken in this way. 24 as well. There are some typical signs of the person of such a pure devotee to indicate his purity. Like this. And then, in this way, the conclusion will be in lesson 26. And then from lesson 27, Vikarana can, this Vikarana can continues with the process of devotional service, taken from the point of view of the disciple, what he's supposed to like, taking qualification of the disciple.
Okay. Yeah.
Just an alternative.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Nice. Yeah. Well, because the point is if you study, then you can teach. So it would work both ways. Yeah. That's nice. Then the vritti. The Sambandha part of the Bhagavad Gita analysis established that the living entities and the material nature are subordinate to Godhead. That the living entities, through although spiritual by nature, are conditioned by the inferior material energy. And they can be freed of this conditioning only by the mercy of Godhead. The Abhideya part describes how the living entities can attain this mercy of Godhead through the process of devotional service. Right, because it's all describing, it's all Sambandha Gyan, but now we're describing the Abhideya part of Sambandha. Right? So in other words, that means this is the position of the living entity he should take up devotional service. And that taking up devotional service, this is how you're going to get the Lord's mercy. Right? Because it's only by his grace one can be free. The Abhideya part is divided into two sections. Man's duty towards Godhead and the nature of Godhead. The first section describes the endeavor made by the devotees to attain the Lord's mercy, and the second section describes the Lord's merciful reciprocation with these sincere endeavors. Only by such causeless reciprocation can a devotee attain the Lord. Right? So what we do and what the Lord reciprocates with. Right? So both sides. Because otherwise we always think of, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. You know, here now it's being explained what God does in reciprocation. The beginning of the Sambandha part established that all living entities are parts and parcels of Godhead. The Abhideya part opens with the same statement, pointing out its natural consequence. You know, so natural consequence is that if you're part and parcel, then you'll serve, right? Okay. Adhikarana 1. Every living being, living entity being God's parts and parcels, it is everyone's duty to cooperate with him by performing transcendental loving service. Lesson 1. Every living entity... okay, same thing. Introduction, page 11. So two divisions of materialistic consciousness. What is this consciousness? This consciousness is I am. Then what is am? Then what am I? In contaminated consciousness, I am means I am the Lord of all I survey. I am the enjoyer. The world revolves because every living being thinks that he is the Lord and creator of the material world. Material consciousness has two psychic divisions. One is that I am the creator, and the other is I am the enjoyer. So material has these two. It's always the foundation of everything. You remove these two, there is no material consciousness. Right? That's why it first is, I am servant of kind the soul, I am servant of God. Right? Krishna is the enjoyer. We'll take that. Okay, that's basic philosophy. Now let's get into some fancy stuff. No. All the fancy stuff is simply applying these two into the particular situation. Fancy simply means the detail. Like that. The principles are never fancy. Right? They're always straightforward. Like that. Yes.
Just to make sure, is this Prabhupada who's writing this?
Means the Adhikarana in this case is always the first lesson of the section. Like that. Previous sometimes it would be the first one and summing up the whole thing. Yes, the conclusion. The first and last, because the two are the same, right? But different like that. Then, where it says lesson, one, every living entity, that's Prabhupada. And then he says introduction, page 11, 7, like this. Mm-hmm. That's what Prabhupada's given. Mm-hmm. Then these parts that are quoted here, then those are Prabhupada from the purports, or from, in this case, the introduction on page 11. Then the thing with the little bullets, all the little stuff like the vritti, all these things, that's what then the author has put in to make it clear and to bring out, you know, what's here. Does that make sense? And then within that, there may be, within that, quotes from other places and other things brought in. But it's there. So what was before given as a set of review questions, like that, here is being given as the point being made. Right? Like that. So in other words, what's on the bullet, the two visions, that's the point to gain from here. You know, does that make sense? Okay. So the actual position of the living entity as a cooperator. But actually, the Supreme Lord is both the creator and the enjoyer. And the living entity, being part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, is neither the creator nor the enjoyer, but a cooperator. He is the created and the enjoyed. For instance, a part of a machine cooperates with the whole machine. A part of the body cooperates with the whole body. The hands, legs, eyes, and so on are all parts of the body. But they are not actually the enjoyers. The stomach is the enjoyer. Right? The legs move, the hands supply food, the teeth chew, and all parts of the body are engaged in satisfying the stomach because the stomach is the principal factor that nourishes the body's organization. Therefore, everything is given to the stomach. One nourishes the tree by watering its root, and one nourishes the body by feeding the stomach. For if the body is to be kept in a healthy state, then the parts of the body must cooperate to feed the stomach. Similarly, the Supreme Lord is the enjoyer and the creator, and we, as subordinate living beings, are meant to cooperate to satisfy Him. Right? So it's everyone's duty to cooperate. This is the point that's being brought out. Is that being part of the whole. Right? So if God is everything, then that means everything that's part of God has to cooperate with God. That's just the natural position, right? The real enjoyment of the living entity is service to the Supreme. This cooperation will actually help us, just as food taken by the stomach will help all other parts of the body. The fingers of the hand think that they should take the food themselves instead of giving it to the stomach, then they will be frustrated. The essential feature of creation and of enjoyment is the Supreme Lord, and the living entities are cooperators. By cooperation, they enjoy. The relation is also like that of the master and the servant. The master is fully satisfied, then the servant is satisfied. Similarly, the Supreme Lord should be satisfied. Although the tendency to become the creator and the tendency to enjoy the material world are there also in the living entities, because these tendencies are there in the Supreme Lord, who has created the manifested cosmic world. So we have those tendencies because the Lord does. But the difficulty is that He is the creator and enjoyer, while we're not. We're the created and enjoyed. Right? So we can cooperate in the Lord's controlling and enjoying. And by that, we'll be satisfied. Just like when it gives the example, the fingers, by trying to enjoy the food themselves, will be frustrated. That's why the living entity in the material world is frustrated. Right? So that's why I said passion and anger. Because the desire to enjoy, but the frustration of not being able to. Right? So that's always going to be the factor. But if we please the Lord, then that anger goes away. That passion goes away. Right? Because suffering comes from passion. Right? Ignorance is automatically. Means, see, goodness, the beginning, middle, and end, it's nice. Right? Like that. Passion, in the beginning it seems good, but it gets the result later, becomes bad. Ignorance is always bad. Beginning, middle, and end. Does that make sense? So you're looking at the... But in the mode of passion, it's good in the beginning, good in the end. But that's just our perception of it.
And the mode of ignorance is also... Is this not nice a little bit in the beginning?
It's like... let us put it like this. The worm and stool, is it nice?
No.
For to the worm?
But yeah.
Yeah, so therefore, why does he think it's nice and you don't? Because he's in full, you know, consciousness of his position. Or he's in ignorance. Uh-huh. So the person in ignorance thinks ignorance is nice.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's interesting. And then in goodness, it's like austerity. You know, it's like
means you know it's nice, though you may not appreciate it immediately. But with time, you do. But with practice, then it'll be always nice.
One gets a taste.
Yeah, one gets a taste. But in the beginning, then it will appear to not be nice. Mm-hmm. But because through knowledge you know it is, then it becomes. Well, passion immediately appears to be good, but you know, you get the result, and then with time, then things start to not work out so good. You know what I'm saying? 7-3. Out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection, and of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. Only the devotee can know Krishna. It is not possible for the Brahman realized impersonalist, or the Paramatma realized yogi, to understand Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as the son of Mother Yashoda, or the charioteer of Arjuna. Even the great demigods are sometimes confused about Krishna. Muhyanti yat surayaha. Mam tu veda na kashchana. No one knows me as I am, the Lord says. And if one does know him, then samahatma sadur laba. Such a great soul is very rare. Therefore, unless one practices devotional service to the Lord, one cannot know Krishna as he is, tattvataha, even though he is a great scholar or philosopher. Only the pure devotee can know something of the inconceivable transcendental qualities in Krishna, his being the cause of all causes, his omnipotence and opulence and his wealth, fame, strength, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation, because Krishna is benevolently inclined to his devotees. He is the last word in Brahman realization, and the devotees alone can realize him as he is. So those who are not devotees, they may be able to realize Brahman, but they can't realize the person, the Supreme Brahman. You know, the yogis also, though they're dealing with the person, they can't understand Krishna. They can't understand his pastimes. That he sits in the heart, that he controls the creation, that they may be able to appreciate. But that he is, you know, the son of Mother Yashoda, that he's driving Arjuna's chariot, that they can't understand. Because that takes devotion. Right? That takes affection. Right? It's only through affection that you can understand the personality. Otherwise, you appreciate qualities. Right? So the impersonalist and the yogi, then they appreciate, you know, God's greatness, his unlimitedness, his power, you know, his omnipotence, omnipresence, all these different elements. But the person behind that they don't appreciate. You know what I'm saying? You know, you can go in, look at a big company, big factory, offices, everything's well organized. You can appreciate that. But it doesn't mean you can appreciate the person who is the cause of that. Does that make sense? Yes?
Being neophytes, can we say that we also fall into this Mayavadi thing, that we only appreciate not the person, but the...
To some degree, but the person is being appreciated, that's why one's called a devotee. If one only appreciated Brahman or Paramatma, then we wouldn't use the term devotee. We'd say, you know, yogi or jnani. Right? Because we appreciate, but we may not be able to fully appreciate. But that doesn't mean we don't appreciate. You know, it's just like, you know, somebody has an idea of the guy, but he may not appreciate as much as his mother does. You know what I'm saying? Why? Because she has more devotion. Like that. So the devotee has, but he has to watch out for these anartas that may be based on this gyan, karma, gyan, and yoga. Okay. Well, here they're not even, karmas aren't even mentioned, right? Because they don't even have a concept of transcendence. While the impersonalists and the yogis do. So what we're pointing out is even they can't know that. Because here, out of thousands amongst men, that's just the ordinary person, one may endeavor for perfection. And out of those who have achieved perfection, because one endeavors, but not necessarily everybody gets. So of those even who have gotten, they don't even know me. Hardly one knows me in truth. So only the devotee is knowing. The other ones don't know. So, yes?
So here it says only the pure devotee can know something. So does that mean that the neophyte is somehow counted as a pure in the middle part of the paragraph? Only the pure devotee.
Yeah, means as means because otherwise, where's your attention? The pure devotee means the attention's on Krishna. Mm. If one's not in the pure state, where's the attention?
then it's on all sorts.
It's on all sorts of things. So how you'll know Krishna? Mm. Because why? Because the pure. But it's not that the pure devotee is not engaged in all those different things. But those things themselves are only important because they're connected to Krishna. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yes. So we're basically dealing with Shraddha or.
Yeah. So therefore, when one is engaged in these other elements, not on the platform of pure devotion, means you're engaging with that aspect on its own, right? Because you like it or you feel it's important or something, but Krishna's not involved. That's why it's not called pure devotion, right? If Krishna's involved, then one sees Krishna. Krishna's not involved, one won't see. You know what I'm saying? So when one's chanting or in the temple, then one is acting on that platform, right? So therefore, one's getting that benefit in knowing Krishna. But when one may not be in those situations doing direct devotional service, we may not appreciate. Is that what you're saying? And so by not appreciating, then we're distracted. But as it will say later, that even such a situation, Krishna will see that the devotee doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, if you really want to go away, of course he'll let you go away. You know, but probably not without some trouble. You still bump into devotees and stuff like that. Like that. You know what I'm saying? But the point is Krishna will arrange that we have the opportunity to see what's appropriate. Just. Seven. O conqueror of wealth, there is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. The absolute truth is the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. There is a common controversy over whether the supreme absolute truth is personal or impersonal. A common controversy. As far as Bhagavad Gita is concerned, the absolute truth is the personality of Godhead. Right? You know, from this you can catch Prabhupada's mood. For them, there's no question of it. So this is just a common controversy. You know, and some say like that. You know, even the demigods. So it's very easy because they just see from that perspective. Right? In other words, it's not a matter of memorizing this philosophy. Right? It's a matter of understanding it, practicing it, and realizing it. Does that make sense? Because of realization, then automatically one knows all the philosophy. Does that make sense? That's the point. So that's from this study, that's what we're looking for. You know, so that's why it goes through this way. The analyzation is this way. Right? And so then that's why we may find, like, you know, in this last week, you know, different devotees have found that, you know, their material concept, you know, is starting to, you know,
crumble,
you know. And so these kind of things, that's what it's for, is so that one will have that realization. Then all this has meaning. You know what I'm saying? It's not a matter of that one's memorized this. Like that. It means if you have the memory to do that, then, you know, all glories, you know. But the point is that that may not be common. You know, out of many thousands of men, one may be able to remember them. Right? You know, so therefore, is that what I'm saying? Yeah. So here, it's interesting just how he puts it. You know, he doesn't say the Maya bodies and that, they have to, because he never puts it that it's on an equal level. We'll have a tendency to go, well, the yogis are saying that, and we're saying this, and others are saying that. No. You know, Krishna's saying this, and then all the materialists, they have all these other philosophies. So the point is that what is being given here by Krishna, this is the reality. Anything else is not. You know what I'm saying? But because it's part of his creation, and the modes of nature are created by him. Therefore, all they're doing is taking stuff that is real and mixing it up and making it not real. Does that make sense? That's the point. They're only taking elements of God's creation. They can't create something new. That's the point. And so, does that make sense? You know, like a yeah. how you say, it's like a, be technical here, just like a California pizza, right? Now normally you have the salad, you have the soup, you have the and you have the pizza, right? But California pizza means you take elements of the salad or the soup and put them on the pizza. You know what I'm saying? So you end up with something very different. Now it's just somehow better for your health. Now this is a healthy pizza, like that. You know, but you could have just eaten the salad and the soup and then eaten the pizza as it was. But whatever it is, the Californians, you know, they're way out there. You know, it's the West Coast. You know, it's a long way away from civilization. You know, like that. So, you know, so they come up with this concept. And so then, does that make sense? So that's all the materials they're doing. They're taking Krishna's creation. Already things, patterns are set, everything's, the mechanics are there. And they just put them together in their own way and say they've come up with something new. Right?
South Beach diet.
Yes, South Beach diet. You know, so all these different things. Yeah. Yeah, if it's going to get into nutrition and diet, then it may not be.
Farming.
Okay.
Biodynamic farming. It seems like Rudolf Steiner. Where did he get, you know, like he has a type of schooling as well. Where did all that come from?
It may have been the association with the other reindeer. So that means that probably from sitting there with nothing to do for most of the year, you know, hearing Santa pontificate on various things. So then, you know, he probably got it there. Point is that farming means you put the seed in the ground and it grows, right? So then it's just a matter of what techniques of putting the seed into the ground and, you know, so that it grows nicely, you get the right results that, gets the best results. So he's just noticed certain things, and so therefore he's pushing that. But there's so many aspects. So it's an aspect. It's not the aspect. You know, I'm just saying, just like, means if you eat the meal, you won't get so much flavor. It means the flavor comes out because of the salt. So if we say, so therefore salt is the essence, therefore we can just eat salt. You understand? So in other words, it's a part. But the point is when you have a forest, how is it growing? Right? Everything that matches with everything else is growing there. So it's already there, God's created. So people observe it, and then they apply that. That's all. You know what I'm saying? Apple fell off a tree, and it, you know, went down. Right? It didn't like fall off and float around and all that and float off into space. Otherwise, Newton would have a different theory. Right? But it went straight down. So therefore, then he notices that, and then from that, he's able to apply that into other things. But it's already God's law. So no one's acting outside of God's law. But what it is they're not attributing it to God, and because of that, they're not appreciation of the personal aspects, so therefore tradition and other things. So they don't necessarily put all these aspects together in a way that is able to be appreciated by, you know, those who are more refined. You know what I'm saying? So the elements that they'll use, these are just there because they work. If it didn't work, he wouldn't be professing it. You know what I'm saying? But it works because those are the laws that Krishna's given, right? But in the Shastra, it'll give something. But just, it's been a long time, so somebody sits out there and notices that, you know, where the cow dung is sitting there on the ground, the plants are a little greener, so then, hey, we got something here. I've discovered something, right? No, it's always been there. The fertilizer makes things grow better. Does that make sense? So, it's a nice thing, but it's not that now you become a, you know, how you say, you join the reindeer club here, and you know what I'm saying? And become, that's your whole life, and that's what you talk about, and that's what you meditate on. And no, it's just part of what works. Just like the cook, they put salt. They're not meditating the whole time about salt, and how they're going to put salt, and how it's time to put salt, and I did put salt. You know, like that. No, it's just one of the things in the whole process. Does that make sense? That I can't say is that what is the particular line that how it goes, but you know, farming and that's generally something that goes back, you know, millions of years. So that's something in some little region somewhere, you know, the Mughals didn't go through there and kill everybody, so there was still somebody left there that knew how to do that technique. You know, and then the Turks went through the other way, but they also missed that village. Like that, and then the Germanic tribes across the top, so they're just sitting in this little corner there, and then so they keep techniques that are like these guys here that do these grassroots. There's knots that they make that are super simple to tie, but they're so sophisticated that there's not one of them's got enough brain to create that. You know how when you want to tie something and you want to make it really tight, you need another person there, you know, or using your nose or something or like that. They have knots. You don't have to do that. And not only that, you can make it tighter yourself. So they put the thing and the way they do it, the way they tie it, they get it to the point they can put pressure on it. And then they can beat the bamboo in that and make it even tighter. And then they cut it off. So just with one hand, they do it. So I've never seen, there is not a knot like that in the West, even though they have such a sophisticated array of knots. You know, on the boats, they have these knots that if you leave them as they are, it doesn't matter what happens. The rope will break, but it won't come undone. At the same time, you can just take your hand and flip it the other way. Without undoing it, it comes loose. You know what I'm saying? So these are just things that have always been there. And just, they're handed down is through these arts where people just are doing them practically. The place where the philosophy, culture, and everything is lost is basically with your intellectuals and those who are not on the ground doing something practical. Because they don't mind separating it. Does that make sense? You know, like when a baby starts to talk, what do they talk? Yeah, it's all kind of just maybe like this. So it doesn't mean anything, but does the child feel, what do you call it? What do you say, you know, feeling bad about that they're bad talking? You know, they feel insecure or they feel that there's something less because they're not, you know, the first words weren't, you know, some quote from Shakespeare.
Inadequate.
Yeah, inadequate, right? No. And so therefore, they can relate to those sounds because that's what they make, right? So the interesting thing is the traditional way that was used for thousands of years of teaching English was to start with all those sounds, like that. But you just articulate it so they're getting the clear sounds. And it means absolutely nothing. And then they get all the sounds right, then you start to put the sounds together and make the words. Right, because words are made out of syllables, right? And sentences are made out of words, right? That's the natural thing. Start with, you know, sounds, syllables, words, sentences, right? But then everything was going great and everyone was learning very efficiently until some academic somewhere in the Age of Enlightenment thought that this is insulting to our children that we have to expose them to this, you know, just all this babbling. Because they, as an adult, would feel that's stupid. Right? So they apply to the kids the same thing, but the kids couldn't care less. Right? So therefore, then they created these systems that were more sophisticated than an adult would be pleased with. Right? And instead of starting with the syllables, and in the word, it means like when you do sentence construction, they don't start with word construction. That's considered advancing. No, word construction is first. Then you can make a sentence. Right? So they skip out on the babbling, then basically word construction, and they go straight to sentence construction. And then they wonder why it takes Johnny so long to learn how to read and write and do everything. You understand? So it happens because they're not practically involved in it. They sit somewhere and think about it, but they don't do it. You know what I'm saying? The PhDs who sit around and make the concepts of how to teach English are not teaching nursery school kids how to read. Not one of them. You understand? So, the farmers, you have to farm. It doesn't work, you die. It's that simple. Like that. You know, and so farmers, some of these other techniques and things like that, making cloth and that, these things haven't changed. Even you have this big fancy machine that makes cloth, it still makes it in the same way the guy made it by hand. You know what I'm saying? So all these things, then generally, there's a tendency that they stay. But it's only because they work. So in other words, it's still the same principle that God made the creation. It's His laws by which things function. So just they're more in touch with the laws. Unfortunately, they're not so intellectual about it to try to understand the laws. So because of that, then the intellectual comes along and applies their intellect on that principle. And then, because they're not God conscious, they come up with some other thing that would look more logical if we adjusted it like this. And then all the other academics, they laud his you know, this is a seminal work here. And then the problem is then when it then goes back to the, you know, the person who's practically doing, it doesn't work anymore. And it gets lost.
It's the video One Cat, One Hand. And at the end it says he goes to the Bhakti Vedanta Academy in Mysore. And I actually looked it up. I think it's a Rick Smith farm.
Who knows? Means this name, we've had this name since 84.
Yeah.
But we didn't actually put it out to be used until recently. Like that. Because we knew as soon as it went out, then everyone would use it. There's at least four or five academies. Yeah. So the point is that they're God's law, so it doesn't change what's being brought out here. These are just different ways to observe it. In other words, you hear the authority, Shruti. Then we go to apply that in our life. That we say, so here, you know, the interest is there in farming, you apply it there. Someone else is in cooking, someone else is in managing, someone else is in economics. But you can see that these laws are what works. Like that. Otherwise, why is there a system? Why is it you can have a world authority on economics? Because there's laws. And they never had problem with it. It's everybody else who doesn't know the laws that they have problems with economics. You know, it's just like the man who runs the casino has no problem with gambling. He never loses money. Right? When they say house always wins, it's not house generally wins, house sometimes wins. No, the term is house always wins. Because they know that, yes, mathematically, then someone could come in, and if they went until they won and then left, which would be intelligent, then house would always lose. Right? But they know money, and they know that when you apply, you know, I mean, they don't know it this technical, but when you apply that natural love for Krishna, when it's perverted and it's applied on money, it's called greed. So they know that he won. He can't leave. Greed will come up. And so therefore he'll want to follow the same process and get more. So he'll invest it again in another, you know, gambling arrangement, and he will lose it. Right? Does that make sense? So in other words, as long as he's enthusiastic, he'll keep going. Right? And when he loses all enthusiasm, he'll stop. But he loses enthusiasm when he loses, not when he wins. So therefore, house will always win. So in other words, for the person owning the gambling casino, they never, it's not speculation for them. It's not gambling. It's sinful. Right? But it's not it's just a straightforward economic enterprise. Right? Does that make sense? So in the same way is that all these different areas, they know what it is, so it works. But persons who don't have the knowledge, there is speculative. You know? Or who have knowledge but don't have the practical application, because how do you know your knowledge works unless you apply it? Does that make sense? Yes.
Maharaj, about the California pizza story, it's like that's why there's a really strong focus on following the footsteps of the acharyas, isn't it? Because everything is already given, so we don't have.
Yes. Yes, that's it. That's
although the Californians could have been a lot more creative and made like a the crust, like a burpee or something, you know, so like they're eating it and they have it.
But that would only be a Gujarati where you'd have sweet and salty at the same time. Like that. So like that. Yeah. But that's why they have the authorized, government recognized Napoli pizzas in Italy and so. Just for that. No, there's authorized the way a real Napoli pizza is made. It's got a government stamp on it. It has to be made in a certain way.
That from Italy?
Yeah, in Italy. No, it's in Italy. You don't find it anywhere else. But I'm saying they may cook it, but I'm saying in Italy they have. There's places they won't cook anything else other than the original. So I think there's only three pizzas. There's no variation. So like that, then the tradition, yeah.
Seems you can throw anything
on
the
pizza
and call
it pizza. Basically. Just like you can throw anything in a pot and call it food. Yes. Yes.
Just to comment on the question of biodynamic farming. Actually, Rudolf Steiner, he told his students to go to India to study how they maintained the quality of the soil even after so many years of farming, and they combined it with the knowledge of the almanac. There was some knowledge in the traditional Western farming about when to put different seeds in the soil according to what the moon faces and all those kinds of things. So that was kind of mixed up, and that became the Bible.
But even that Western thing would have been something left over from before. You know, because generally speaking, if you had a brain, you might get burned at the stake. But if you could grow subjects nicely, you generally weren't called a witch. So, you know, generally those people were left, you know, like that. So there'd be some stuff like that. But you just, it's a simple thing. When the moon is, you know, waning or waxing, that's when you deal. So nobody's going to get too freaked out that that's, you know, to do with, you know, witches and demons and stuff. So. So it still all eventually goes back. Okay. There is a common controversy over whether the Supreme Absolute Truth is personal or impersonal. As far as Bhagavad Gita is concerned, the Absolute Truth is the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. And this is confirmed in every step. In this verse, in particular, it is stressed that the Absolute Truth is a person. Right? So Gita accepts this. And in every step it's being established. It's not just once it was mentioned, but in every step. Okay, and in this particular verse it is stressed that the Absolute Truth is a person. That the personality of Godhead is the Supreme Absolute Truth is also the affirmation of the Brahma Samhita, Ishvara Paramakrishna Satchidananda Vigraha. That is, the Supreme Absolute Truth, Personality of Godhead, is Lord Krishna, who is the primeval Lord, the reservoir of all pleasure, Govinda, and the eternal form of complete bliss and knowledge. These authorities leave no doubt that the Absolute Truth is the Supreme Person, the cause of all causes. So establishing that he's a person, because otherwise we can establish that, yes, okay, the jiva is subordinate to the Supreme, right? But now that he's a person, that's not necessarily, because otherwise the yogis and the impersonalists, they accept that the living entity is Brahman, right? Is eternal, is coming from God, whatever their concept is. But the element that God's a person, that's what's not brought out. So as far as establishing the philosophy, than just working on the principle. You're establishing him as a person, but the emphasis is not so much on that as that we are spiritual, the Lord is supremely spiritual, there's a natural relationship there. We don't have a relationship with the material world, which is temporary. That's what we're trying to break. Right? And then, as the author points out, then the natural next step is, if God's a person, and we're related to him, and we're subordinate, what does that mean? Right? So that means the next step will be, we will serve. You know, devotional service. So it's been brought out before, but it's all philosophical. But now it's the practical that this has to be applied. Right? Riti. The living entities are obliged to cooperate with the Lord in order to attain their goals. After establishing this in the first lesson, in the second lesson, Srila Prabhupada describes the two types of living entities who are obliged to cooperate with the Lord, the fallible and the infallible. But, so there means this first point is established. The living entity has to cooperate. So whether it's materially or spiritually, you have to cooperate. Right? And is the material is a reflection of the spiritual. If you have the spiritual, the material is already taken care of. Right? If you're cooking for Krishna, then there's already food cooked. You don't cook for Krishna and then cook for yourself. It's not a separate endeavor. By cooking for Krishna, there's already food. You understand? By taking care of your house for Krishna, you have a house. By taking care of your car for Krishna, you have a car. Yeah, a point that many temples could learn. does that make sense? So does that make sense? One doesn't have to worry about that. Now we're going to establish that there's two kinds of living entities that have to cooperate, right? The fallible and the infallible. Lesson two. There are two types of living entities. A, those who are in the material world, and B, those who are in the spiritual world. So then, verse 15:16. There are two classes of beings, the fallible and the infallible. In the material world, every living entity is fallible, and in the spiritual world, every living entity is called infallible. So that includes the Supreme Person, but we've already dealt with that. Right? Fallible means changing the body, so that's the definition, you understand. So Krishna's infallible, he doesn't change the body. The residents of the spiritual world are infallible, they don't change the body. Right? Another place we see fallible means that you become controlled by the modes of nature. Right? So, but what's the effect of the control of the modes of nature in relation to this? We change body, right? Because there's passion, it's created, goodness, it's maintained, there's ignorance, it's destroyed. Right? So it's the same thing. That's why it's always very important to note that it's not two different definitions. It's two aspects of the same thing, just taking the different... If you're taking about control, the living entity wants to be the controller, but he's controlled by the modes. The Lord is not controlled by the modes. He is the controller. So he's infallible. We're fallible. You know?
So when we're not misapplying anything, then there's no need for change.
Yes, there's no need for change. Because why do you have to change? You don't have to change a good thing. Right? You understand? Unless you're into this modern kind of concept, and of course you have to change it. I can vaguely remember, but one of the probably overwhelming elements, you could probably say, the 50s, was that man-made is better. Like that, man is he's taken. Just nature, it's just happened by chance, but man applies his intelligence and improves on it. So therefore, anything made by man was better. Like that. So you had your vitamins and anything, crops grown with artificial things were always better. And I remember at that time, cotton and all the natural things were real cheap. And, you got the polyester shirt, that was more expensive. But the well-made, nice cotton shirt, that was cheaper, right? And then with time, it went for a while. It had a good run, like that. They had 40 years like that. And then they kind of figured out it's not as good, right? And then after 50 years, now the cotton shirt costs more. Right?
Even feeding the baby, it wasn't okay to give mother's milk. The formula was better.
Yeah, because it was very, designed just for the kid.
Scientific.
So like this is that the point is no, God's not under the control of the modes. He is the controller. It is his laws. Therefore, those who follow it, there's no need to change. Right? So the spiritual world goes on eternally. The spiritual body is eternal. The relationship is eternal. This is perfect. But in the material world, it's not perfect, so naturally you have to scrap it and start again. In the material world, the living entity undergoes six changes: birth, growth, duration, reproduction, then dwindling and vanishing. One, the way it's presented, one would wonder if dwindling and vanishing have anything to do with reproduction. Because it's birth, growth, duration, reproduction, then dwindling and vanishing. You know, yeah, I think it was just that kind of like a cliche is that, you know, some of the kids are talking to, you know, someone else, you know, an older person about how, you know, boring and, you know, kind of like out of it their parents are, you know. And then, you know, that they're looking at, you know, pictures or something before, and it seemed their parents were, you know, more enthusiastic and more, you know, spontaneous and all that. And so then the question comes up, what happened to them? You know, where did it go wrong? And then the other person points out, they had you. Now their energy went into taking care of you. That's what made them, you know, dwindling and vanish. Yeah. These are the changes of the material body. But in the spiritual world, the body does not change. There is no old age. There is no birth. There is no death. They all exist in oneness. Kshadak sarvani bhutani. Any living entity who has to come in contact with matter, beginning from the first created being, Brahma, down to a small ant, is changing its body. Therefore, they are all fallible. In the spiritual world, however, they are always liberated in oneness. Right? Oneness meaning that it's always the same. It's always transcendental. Because the modes of nature, you have the opposites. The creation, destruction. Right? But there you only have goodness. So therefore it's that one principle. It's not duality. It's that oneness. Right? Does that make sense? But this is oneness with quality, not without.
In the spiritual world, like, everybody are the same. They all know each other, and then one jiva pops up from being transferred from material world to the form of Vrindavan, and then up. And then nobody wonders where this one came from.
Oh, this depends on whether there's a little puff of smoke or not. Oh, hey, another jiva. Yeah, cool. Where are you from? Yeah, it's just like that. Oh, from the Bronx. Okay, cool. Yeah, okay, thanks. Like that. Yeah. Oh, you're from the Bronx. He was from Jersey. Like that. You know, so. That's why one appears in the Boma Lila, because one has a family there. Right? In other words, you have a position, you fall from that position, it doesn't mean that position's not there. You know, so the family and all that, you're just taking a break. Does that make sense? So one goes back to that same position. Does that make sense? Glories of so much wool. Hey, where's my water bottle?
But you're not considering polyester?
No.
You did just but, for a moment.
But yeah, I mean, she's got this, you know, extremely warm but very fuzzy asan, and then all these cheddars, and then, you know, so you end up with a lot of lint. Okay. Does that make sense? So you go back to the position you were. So that's why you go to Boma Lila, because then it's established that you're from this family, from this village. Because otherwise, if you just appear in a puff of smoke, and you know, they ask you where you're from, and you know, you say Fifth Avenue or something, they go, well, what Fifth Avenue? It's not going to work.
Yeah, family knows the family knows you're missing. Well, you came back.
See, the point is that the family itself is a manifestation of the Sundini potency. So it's not necessarily that they're jivas. It doesn't have to be. It's just that's the arrangement. You know what I'm saying? So that's the. You know what I'm saying? These are details. it's like when you get there, it'll make sense. You don't have to worry about it so much now. You know,
we just want to know if we missed or not.
It means by when Gopa Kumara went back, then Krishna, when he met him, then he embraced him, they fell on the ground unconscious. So then all the Brajbasis, they saw this. All they know is that this guy wasn't around before. And now he has, by Krishna coming and touching him, Krishna went unconscious. So they thought he's one of the demons from that Kamsa has sent. So there's going to be a big riot there. And then Krishna, you know, woke up, and then, you know, we'll get into all this stuff. And, you know, in the Bhagavatam study. Yeah, the next course. Like that. So there will be more will be discussed on that level. Jiva Dharma will get into it, so next year also. Yeah. But here we're just trying to work out we're not God. This year's course is to confirm what we learned last year, that God's God and we're not. Something very...
Well, because I heard that, first of all, time doesn't really exist in the spiritual world like you think.
But there's a concept of time. But, you know, you're talking about 3/4 seconds, one life of Brahma. So it's not necessarily long time.
We're just like momentarily not conscious there, and then we're, you know, back to being conscious.
Yeah. But while you're here, it seems like a long time, yeah. Yeah. It's still there because of the affection for Krishna and the intensity of it. It's still perceived as a long time there. But it's not a long time. Okay, so we understand that this oneness means it's the pure goodness. Oneness in that is the same quality as the Lord. It's not oneness meaning that there's no qualities. So one has to be comfortable that this term of oneness, it's our term, but it means saguna, right? It means one on the transcendental platform, one's always on that platform, there's no change, right? Material world means duality, right? But what we avoid is when somebody says, no, there's exclusive monism, that there's only Brahman, and there is no personality and all that. Then we say, no, there's two. You understand? Because we're talking about living entities. We're not talking about the situation. They're talking about living entities. Because there can't be a situation. Because if it's all Brahman, there is no situation. What we understand is what they're talking about is simply a situation. Where you're situated. Not actually the nature of the entities that are there in their relationship. Does that make sense? So we're very careful. We don't get confused. So for us, these are all elements of situation. Right? Does that make sense? The personality of Godhead, that's the relationship. Right? So one is in the relationship eternally with the Lord and his devotees, situated on the spiritual platform. So that's the oneness. And the variegatedness is that the interactions between those living entities on that platform of oneness. Does this make sense? Yeah? You know, it's a matter of our attachment, because of our attachment to Gyan, then we get this element of oneness has a particular meaning. You know, just like we are attached to sense gratification, therefore sense gratification has a certain meaning. Right? So it means if the senses are engaged in the sense objects, that's sense gratification. But for us, no, that's the mechanics of the senses. If the goal of that mechanics is your own pleasure, that's sense gratification. If the mechanics of the engaging the senses, its goal is to please Krishna, that's called devotional service. You understand? So we have to get used to that these different words have deeper meanings. You know, so there's a variety of usages. But we're used to using them in a particular way because of our own attachments. So much of the time they're used in that way to not disturb the attachments. But once we've established the point, what's the next step? Disturb the attachment. Right? You know what I'm saying? In other words, once we've accepted the point, means if by dealing directly with our attachment, we won't accept the point. You don't bother with the attachment. You deal with the point. Once the point's accepted, now you can see the attachment and relationship to the point. Then you deal with the point. You know what I'm saying? That's why Acharyas, it's not a matter of go in and just surrender means giving up everything. No, surrender means connecting everything to Krishna. You know what I'm saying? When we're more neophyte, though, that means, you know, getting rid of everything and just like this and that. You know what I'm saying? It is. It's the ideal form of surrender. You know, so that's not wrong also, right? But the point is that it's a matter of finding what is sustainable. Right? Does that make sense? Oneness with God means unity of purpose. The living entities are eternally separated parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When they are in contact with the material world, they are called Jiva Bhuta. And the Sanskrit words given here, Kshara Sarvani Bhutani, mean that they are fallible. Those who are in oneness with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, however, are called infallible. Oneness does not mean that they have no individuality, but there is no disunity. They are all agreeable to the purpose of the creation. Right? So when one's in tune, or in here, agreeable to the purpose of the creation, then there's no difficulty. So there's a oneness there. Because the fact of who we are, who God is, what the material world, that's just facts. But the discerning element on whether we call it spiritual, material, transcendental, is the consciousness. Whether this unity of purpose is there or not. Yes?
Why does the false ego think that if it surrenders everything to Krishna, we lose out? I mean, don't get in, you know.
Because of that original principle, we're the controller and enjoyer. So that's why it's the first statement. Means everything else after that's going to be based on accepting that principle. It means the solution to all the other problems has to begin with, we understand we're not the controller and enjoyer. Right? As long as we think we're the controller and enjoyer, then we'll always have a problem with a particular point, understanding a particular application. You know, I'm managing for Krishna, right? And it is service to Krishna. It is supposed to be arranged. But I'm thinking I'm the one who's controlling and making it all happen, rather than it's Krishna's potency of management that we are an instrument for is doing it. So therefore, because I think I'm the controller, and everybody should appreciate what great work I did. Right? In other words, he did so much like that, and then everybody was talking about the great Abhishek, and the feast was great, and everything like that. And you're thinking, hey, but what? I made all the arrangements. And then next time when it comes around, then you're not interested, because nobody cared. So that meant because you thought you were the controller and the enjoyer. You did it, and the results of that should be yours. You know what I'm saying? But it was for Krishna, so you got the spiritual benefit. Does that make sense? But that's an anartha, so you won't advance more and be able to do more for Krishna because of this anartha. So that's why it's first. Because that's where it starts. I'm the controller and the enjoyer. Right? Everything else is a detail of that. So I'm the controller is the jnani, and the enjoyer is the karma. That's why we can say there's only karma and jnana, because there's just these two points. I'm the controller and the enjoyer. Does that make sense? Okay, vritti. Having described the general characteristics, see what also how this is working is you have a lesson. It establishes a point. And as we said before, establishing the point, you've accepted that, but now in applying that, then a new doubt will come up. Right? So then the vritti will bring out what is that next doubt. Okay. Vritti. Having described the general characteristics of the two types of living entities, the fallible and the infallible, in lessons 3-5, Srila Prabhupada describes in detail the two types of fallible living entities, the demoniac and the divine. Right? Because now, the infallible, we understand that's what's there. We're trying to get to that platform. But that means we're not infallible. We're fallible. Now, of the two kinds of fallible, then there's the divine and the demoniac. So divine means they're willing to move in the direction of the infallible, right? And the demoniac is they have their own idea, right? So what direction they're going, that we don't. You know, in other words, if you're on the razor's edge, that's divine. If you're not, that's demoniac. So the demoniac has a lot of variety, right? Does that make sense? So within the divine, then you have kanista madhyamutam, right? So it just means how committed you are to following the footsteps of the infallible, right? And the demoniac, then, as many, you know, how you say, as many ways there are paths, you know, like that, yes. Like that. So. Lesson 3. Those who are in the material world are all subjected to the threefold miseries inflicted by the material energy. 15.7. The living entities in this conditioned world are my fragmental parts. Due to conditional life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. Right, so this is the, these are means where it has here the verse. That's always the translation, right? Yeah. Yeah. So this is these are directly the translation. So before I was asking what's here. So in other words, only the things that's in the 10-point, that's in the vritti or in the bullets. Is there any other way you present? Or?
Footnotes.
These are then the author has put in to make it clear so the study goes well. Right? And the organization of this to put the things here and bring the things from the purports and all that, then that's been organized by the author. Is that okay? Due to conditioned life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. The living entity is eternally fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. In this verse, the identity of the living being is clearly given. The living entity is the fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, eternally. Not that at some point they're not, you know, or who they weren't. No, they always have been. It is not that he assumes individuality in his conditional life, and in his liberated states become one with the Supreme Lord. We're saying one with the purpose, not one with the entity. Right? He is eternally fragmented. It is clearly said, sanatana. Okay, when the living entity misuses his independence, he struggles very hard in the material world. So now we've described that he is always there, always will be there. Right? That being established, now when he misuses his independence, then he struggles very hard. Every living entity is as an individual soul has his personal individuality and a minute form of independence. By misuse of that independence, one becomes a conditioned soul. Right? So by proper use of one's independence, one becomes a liberated soul. Right? So that's the point. Fallible means he's not cooperating. It's misuse of his independence. And infallible means one's harmonious with the purpose of the Lord. So therefore he uses his independence properly. And by proper use of independence, he is always liberated. In either case, he is qualitatively eternal, as the Supreme Lord is. Right? So that doesn't change. Qualitatively, he is. So when the Brahmavadis say, yes, we are eternal, like that, and in that way, we're saying we're one with the Lord, that's correct. But to say that there will be no individuality in that oneness, and to say that that is the ultimate position, there's no personality of Godhead and eternal, transcendental pastimes, that's where their philosophy falls short. In the liberated state, he is free from material condition, and he is under the engagement of transcendental service unto the Lord. In his conditioned life, he is dominated by the material modes of nature, and he forgets the transcendental loving service of the Lord. As a result, he has to struggle very hard to maintain his existence in the material world. Because he wants things. So, because everything you want in the material world is temporary. So that means you have to work very hard to maintain it. You know? Or you want something, you have to work hard to get it, because there has to be a creation. Then it will maintain for a while, then it will dissolve. So then you have to work again. Right? Spiritual world, you don't have that problem. The body doesn't disintegrate. You don't have to worry about that. Your house isn't going to go away. Like that. You know, like that? Does that make sense? The living entities, not only human beings, the living entities, not only human beings, and the cats and dogs, but, oh, okay, not only human beings and the cats and dogs, so they're kind of all put together in one thing, but even the great controllers of the material world, because I was looking for not only living entities, but also the cats and dogs, no, that's it, because the cats and dogs and the human beings go together, but even the greater controllers of the material world, Brahma, Lord Shiva, even Vishnu, are all parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord. So when you put it in that context, then we get thrown in with the cats and dogs. Yeah, okay. So just a way of putting things into perspective, right? The word karshati, struggling or grappling hard, is very significant. Right? Grappling hard means you're wrestling with it, because it doesn't do what you want. You want it to happen in this way, it doesn't happen in that way. You want it to last forever, it doesn't. You want it to actually begin, it doesn't start. Right? You know, so whatever it is, it's temporary. So you're grappling with it. The conditioned soul is bound up as though shackled by iron chains. He's bound up by the false ego, and the mind is the chief agent which is driving him in this material existence. So he's bound up by the false ego, I'm the controller and enjoyer, and the mind is the main cohort here, who is making it all work. Because the mind comes up with all the different ways that I'm going to apply my false ego, and I'm going to control and enjoy. When the mind is in the mode of goodness, his activities are good. When the mind is in the mode of passion, his activities are troublesome. And when the mind is in the mode of ignorance, he travels in the lower species of life. Right? Doesn't even bother saying it's bad. He travels in the lower. Right? That's the pleasant thing. This is the way to use the terms pleasantly. It's not that you don't say them. You just find a way to say it. But it says the point that people would... Like that. He says he travels in the lower species because that's the effect of it. Like the effect of goodness, passion is troublesome, and the effect of goodness is good. Right? So therefore we're... Because right? Otherwise we say it's bad, and people say, no, well, that's not so bad. But you say he travels in the lower species, which is actually the effect, then most people will say that's okay. I mean, I've heard a couple hippie here and there that... You know, yeah, you do this, you become a dog, and you say, well, dogs are nice, you know. You know, they're also, you know, spiritual. They're in tune with nature, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so like that. Then other than them, then most people will figure, okay, well, that's not good. You know, especially the way we take care of our dog, right? You know, kids, they pick... Little kid picks up a cat, right? You pick it up, you know, and so then you grab it under the head and the arms, and the rest of it's just dangling there. You know? That's how you pick up a cat, right? You know, so then one would not want to be the cat. Like that. So, yeah. So here is that the living entity is struggling very hard. So that's because everybody is under Krishna. Everybody's part and parcel. Everyone's come from Krishna. But those who follow his laws, they're infallible, they don't have any problems. Those who don't, they have problems. Right. That makes sense? Yeah. Okay, so I'll end here. Continue then with this 15:8 after the break.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Janyatai Gaurav.